2. Childhood of the Human Hero. The earlier culture hero of the snake body and bull head carried within him from birth the spontaneous creative power of the natural world. That was the meaning of his form. The man hero, on the other hand, must descend to re-establish connection with the infrahuman. This is the sense, as we have seen, of the adventure of the hero. But the makers of legend have seldom rested content to regard the world's great heroes as mere human beings who broke past the horizons that limited their fellows and returned with such boons as any man with equal faith and courage might have found. On the contrary, the tendency has always been to endow the hero with extraordinary powers from the moment of birth, or even the moment of conception. The whole hero life is shown to have been a pageant of marvels, with the great central adventure as its culmination. This accords with the view that herohood is predestined rather than simply achieved, and opens the problem of the relationship of biography to character. Jesus, for example, can be regarded as a man who by dint of austerities and meditation attained wisdom. Or, on the other hand, one may believe that a god descended and took upon himself the enactment of a human career. The first view would lead one to imitate the master literally, in order to break through, in the same way as he, to the transcendent redemptive experience. But the second states that the hero is rather a symbol to be contemplated than an example to be literally followed. The divine being is a revelation of the omnipotent self, which dwells within us all. The contemplation of the life thus should be undertaken as a meditation on one's own immanent divinity, not as a prelude to precise imitation. The lesson being not, do thus and be good, but know this and be God.
This formula is, of course, not precisely that of the common Christian teaching, where, though Jesus is reported to have declared that the kingdom of God is within, the Church is maintained that, since man is created only in the image of God, the distinction between the soul and its creator is absolute, thus retaining, as the final reach of their wisdom, the dualistic distinction between man's eternal soul and the divinity. The transcending of this pair of opposites is not encouraged, indeed is rejected as pantheism, and has sometimes been rewarded with the stake. Nevertheless, the prayers and diaries of the Christian mystics abound in ecstatic descriptions of the unitive, soul-shattering experience, while Dante's vision at the conclusion of the Divine Comedy certainly goes beyond the orthodox, dualistic, concretistic dogma of the finality of the personalities of the Trinity. Where this dogma is not transcended, the myth of going to the Father is taken literally, as describing man's final goal. As for the problem of imitating Jesus as a human model, or meditating upon him as a god, the history of the Christian attitude may be roughly summarized as follows. 1. A period of literally following the Master, Jesus, by renouncing the world as he did, primitive Christianity. 2. A period of meditating on Christ crucified as the divinity within the heart, meanwhile leading one's life in the world as the servant of this God, early and medieval Christianity. 3. A rejection of most of the instruments supporting meditation, meanwhile, however, continuing to lead one's life in the world as the servant or vehicle of the God whom one has ceased to visualize, Protestant Christianity. 4. An attempt to interpret Jesus as a model human being, but without accepting his ascetic path, liberal Christianity.
In Part 1, The Adventure of the Hero, we regarded the redemptive deed from the first standpoint, which may be called the psychological. We now must describe it from the second, where it becomes a symbol of the same metaphysical mystery that it was the deed of the hero himself to rediscover and bring to view. In the present chapter, therefore, we shall consider first the miraculous childhood, by which it is shown that a special manifestation of the immanent divine principle has become incarnate in the world, and then, in succession, the various life roles through which the hero may enact his work of destiny. These vary in magnitude according to the needs of the time. Stated in the terms already formulated, the hero's first task is to experience consciously the antecedent stages of the cosmogonic cycle, to break back through the epochs of emanation. His second, then, is to return from that abyss to the plane of contemporary life, there to serve as a human transformer of demiurgic potentials. Huang Ti had the power to dream. This was his road of descent and return. Vainamonin's second or water birth threw him back to an experience of the elemental. In the Tonga tale of the clam wife, the retreat began with the birth of the mother. The brother heroes sprang from an infrahuman womb. The deeds of the hero in the second part of his personal cycle will be proportionate to the depth of his descent during the first. The sons of the clam wife came up from the animal level. Their physical beauty was superlative. Vainamonin was reborn from the elemental waters and winds. His endowment was to rouse or quell with bardic song the elements of nature and of the human body. Huang Ti sojourned in the kingdom of the spirit. He taught the harmony of the heart. The Buddha broke past even the zone of the creative gods and came back from the void. He announced salvation from the cosmogonic round. If the deeds of an actual historical figure proclaim him to have been a hero, the builders of his legend will invent for him appropriate adventures in depth. These will be pictured as journeys into miraculous realms, and are to be interpreted as symbolic, on the one hand, of descents into the night sea of the psyche, and on the other, of the realms or aspects of man's destiny that are made manifest in the respective lives. King Sargon of Akkadia, circa 2550 BC, was born of a lowly mother. His father was unknown. Set adrift in a basket of bulrushes on the waters of the Euphrates, he was discovered by Aki, the husbandman, whom he was brought up to serve as gardener. The goddess Ishtar favored the youth. Thus he became, at last, king and emperor, renowned as the living god. Chandragupta, 4th century BC, the founder of the Hindu Maurya dynasty, was abandoned in an earthen jar at the threshold of a cow's shed. A herdsman discovered and fostered the infant. One day, when he was playing with his companions a game of high king in the judgment seat, little Chandragupta commanded that the worst of the offenders should have their hands and feet cut off. Then, at his word, the amputated members immediately returned to place. A passing prince, beholding the miraculous game, bought the child for 1,000 harshapanas and at home discovered by physical signs that he was a Maurya. Pope Gregory the Great, AD 540-604, was born of noble twins who at the instigation of the devil had committed incest. His penitent mother set him to sea in a little casket. He was found and fostered by fishermen, and at the age of 6 was sent to a cloister to be educated as a priest. But he desired the life of a knightly warrior. Entering a boat, he was borne miraculously to the country of his parents, where he won the hand of the queen, who presently proved to be his mother. After discovery of this second incest, Gregory remained 17 years in penance, chained to a rock in the middle of the sea. The keys to the chains were tossed to the waters, but when at the end of the long period they were discovered in the belly of a fish, this was taken to be a providential sign. The penitent was conducted to Rome, where in due course he was elected pope. Charlemagne, 742-814, was persecuted as a child by his elder brothers and took flight to Saracen Spain. There, under the name of Mainet, he rendered signal services to the king. He converted the king's daughter to the Christian faith, and the two secretly arranged to marry. After further deeds, the royal youth returned to France, where he overthrew his former persecutors and triumphantly assumed the crown. Then he ruled 100 years, surrounded by a zodiac of 12 peers. According to all reports, his beard and hair were very long and white. Actually, Charles the Great was beardless and bald. One day, sitting under his judgment tree, he rendered justice to a snake, and in gratitude, the reptile bestowed on him a charm that involved him in a love affair with a woman already dead. This amulet fell into a well at Aix. That is why Aix became the emperor's favorite residence. After his long wars against the Saracens, Saxons, Slavs, and Northmen, the ageless emperor died. But he sleeps only, to awake in the hour of his country's need. During the later Middle Ages, he once arose from the dead to participate in a crusade. Each of these biographies exhibits the variously rationalized theme of the infant exile and return. This is a prominent feature in all legend, folktale, and myth. Usually an effort is made to give it some semblance of physical plausibility. However, when the hero in question is a great patriarch, wizard, prophet, or incarnation, the wonders are permitted to develop beyond all bounds. The popular Hebrew legend of the birth of Father Abraham supplies an example of the frankly supernatural infant exile. The event of the birth had been read by Nimrod in the stars.
For this impious king was a cunning astrologer, and it was manifest to him that a man would be born in his day who would rise up against him and triumphantly give the lie to his religion. In his terror at the fate foretold him in the stars, he sent for his princes and governors and asked them to advise him in the matter. They answered and said, "Our unanimous advice is that thou shouldst build a great house, station a guard at the entrance thereof, and make known in the whole of thy realm that all pregnant women shall repair thither together with their midwives, who are to remain with them when they are delivered. When the days of a woman to be delivered are fulfilled, and the child is born, it shall be the duty of the midwife to kill it, if it be a boy. But if the child be a girl, it shall be kept alive, and the mother shall receive gifts and costly garments, and a herald shall proclaim, 'Thus is done unto the woman who bears a daughter.'" The king was pleased with this counsel, and he had a proclamation published throughout his whole kingdom, summoning all the architects to build a great house for him, 60 ells high and 80 wide. After it was completed, he issued a second proclamation, summoning all pregnant women thither, and there they were to remain until their confinement. Officers were appointed to take the women to the house, and guards were stationed in it and about it, to prevent the women from escaping thence. He furthermore sent midwives to the house, and commanded them to slay the men children at their mother's breasts. But if a woman bore a girl, she was to be arrayed in byssus, silk, and embroidered garments, and led forth from the house of detention amid great honors. No less than 70,000 children were slaughtered thus. Then the angels appeared before God and spoke, "Seest thou not what he doth? Yon sinner and blasphemer, Nimrod, son of Canaan, who slays so many innocent babes that have done no harm?" God answered and said, "Ye holy angels, I know it and I see it, for I neither slumber nor sleep. I behold, and I know the secret things and the things that are revealed. And ye shall witness what I will do unto this sinner and blasphemer, for I will turn my hand against him to chastise him." It was about this time that Terah espoused the mother of Abraham, and she was with child. When her time approached, she left the city in great terror, and wandered toward the desert, walking along the edge of a valley, until she happened across a cave. She entered this refuge, and on the next day she was seized with the throes, and she gave birth to a son. The whole cave was filled with the light of the child's countenance, as with the splendor of the sun, and the mother rejoiced exceedingly. The babe she bore was our father, Abraham. His mother lamented, and said to her son, "Alas that I bore thee at a time when Nimrod is king. For thy sake 70,000 men children were slaughtered, and I am seized with terror on account of thee, that he hear of thy existence and slay thee. Better thou shouldst perish here in this cave than my eye should behold thee dead at my breast." She took the garment in which she was clothed and wrapped it about the boy. Then she abandoned him in the cave, saying, "May the Lord be with thee. May he not fail thee nor forsake thee." Thus Abraham was deserted in the cave without a nurse, and he began to wail. God sent Gabriel down to give him milk to drink, and the angel made it to flow from the little finger of the baby's right hand, and he sucked it until he was 10 days old. Then he arose and walked about, and he left the cave and went along the edge of the valley. When the sun sank and the stars came forth, he said, "These are the gods." But the dawn came and the stars could be seen no longer, and then he said, "I will not pay worship to these, for they are no gods." Thereupon the sun came forth, and he spoke, "This is my God, him will I extol." But again the sun set, and he said, "He is no God." And beholding the moon, he called him his God, to whom he would pay divine homage. Then the moon was obscured, and he cried out, "This too is no God. There is one who sets them all in motion."
The Blackfeet of Montana tell of a young monster slayer, Kutoyis, who was discovered by his foster parents when the old man and woman put a clot of buffalo blood to boil in a pot.
Immediately there came from the pot a noise as of a child crying, as if it were being hurt, burnt, or scalded. They looked in the kettle and saw there a little boy, and they quickly took it out of the water. They were very much surprised. Now on the fourth day the child spoke, and said, "Lash me in turn to each of these lodge poles, and when I get to the last one, I shall fall out of my lashing and be grown up." The old woman did so, and as she lashed him to each lodge pole, he could be seen to grow, and finally when they lashed him to the last pole, he was a man.
The folk tales commonly support or supplant this theme of the exile with that of the despised one, or the handicapped, the abused youngest son or daughter, the orphan, stepchild, ugly duckling, or the squire of low degree. A young Pueblo woman who was helping her mother mix clay for pottery with her foot felt a splash of mud on her leg, but thought no more of it.
After some days, the girl felt something was moving in her belly, but she did not think anything about going to have a baby. She did not tell her mother, but it was growing and growing. One day in the morning, she was very sick. In the afternoon, she got the baby. Then her mother knew, for the first time, that her daughter was going to have a baby. The mother was very angry about it. But after she looked at the baby, she saw it was not like a baby. She saw it was a round thing with two things sticking out. It was a little jar. "Where did you get this?" said her mother. The girl was just crying. About that time the father came in.
"Never mind. I am very glad she had a baby," he said.
"But it is not a baby," said her mother. Then the father went to look at it and saw it was a little water jar. After that, he was very fond of that little jar.
"It is moving," he said.
Pretty soon, that little water jar was growing. In 20 days, it was big. It was able to go around with the children, and it could talk. "Grandfather, take me outdoors so I can look around," he said. So every morning, the grandfather would take him out, and he would look at the children, and they were very fond of him. And they found out he was a boy, water jar boy. They found out,
from his talking.
In sum, the child of destiny has to face a long period of obscurity. This is a time of extreme danger, impediment, or disgrace. He is thrown inward to his own depths or outward to the unknown. Either way, what he touches is a darkness unexplored. And this is a zone of unsuspected presences, benign as well as malignant. An angel appears, a helpful animal, a fisherman, a hunter, crone, or peasant. Fostered in the animal school, or like Siegfried, below ground among the gnomes that nourish the roots of the tree of life. Or again, alone in some little room. The story has been told a thousand ways. The young world apprentice learns the lesson of the seed powers, which reside just beyond the sphere of the measured and the named.